No Common Vision on Ukraine. Today, Friday, March 14th, this is The World. I'm Carol Hills, in for Marco Werman. The U.S. says it won't recognize the outcome of Sunday's referendum in Crimea, but Crimeans are already calling the result.
Everyone expects that the vote will be for Russia.
Also, memories of working at a Ukrainian zoo.
Somebody stole a swan and somebody stole an eagle. Luckily, not on my shift, but I can imagine the swan, they probably eaten it.
And later, a Marine Corps trombonist on what fighting wars and playing jazz have in common.
Improvisation is not just making it up as you go along. It's the ability to be creative within and around a known set of boundaries for which you've prepared a great deal.
That's all ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon or Medtronic 10-Mile Run. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes.
I'm Carol Hills, in for Marco Werman, and this is The World. No common vision. That's how Russia's foreign minister summed up his talks today with Secretary of State John Kerry on the crisis in Ukraine. Kerry was more direct. He said the U.S. and the West would not recognize the outcome of Sunday's referendum in Crimea. But despite U.S. efforts to delay it, the vote on whether Crimea should secede from Ukraine and join Russia is expected to happen. The CBC's Derek Stoffel is in the Crimean port of Sevastopol. He says that while Russia supporters there are out waving flags, those who support staying in Ukraine are keeping a low profile.
It is harder to see the pro-Ukrainians. They are out there. You know, it's hard to gauge them. But the pro-Russian messages are all over the place. But the Ukrainians, you know, they don't have the same organization and they don't have the same money. And also, they just don't want to go out because they've been roughed up when they've had rallies. So the pro-Ukrainian side exists. They're there. They support Ukraine, but they're not doing it nearly as vocally.
When you talk to people there, how are they expecting the referendum to go on Sunday?
Everyone expects that the vote will be for Russia. On the Ukrainian side, there's a lot of people who think that the vote will be rigged. Talking to several Ukrainian supporters who say, what can we do? They are going to win this referendum. And that's the big question then becomes, what do we do next? And that is the big question in terms of the uncertainty here. And the people I've been speaking to, I went to a bar the other night, met with some young Ukrainians supporting the Ukrainian side. One of the guys told me that he thinks he's going to have to move back to Ukraine. Another woman, you know, she's got a good job in Simferopol. She wasn't sure. So there's a lot of uncertainty on the pro-Ukrainian side. On the other side, you know, those who back Russia, they're excited. I just met a woman, an older woman. She said she's been waiting to cast her ballot for Russia for more than 20 years now. She's very excited about all this.
It's interesting. You mentioned a pro-Ukrainian person that you said back to Ukraine, but of course Crimea is still technically part of Ukraine. But anyway, we've been hearing stories about an influx of Russian troops and materiel into Sevastopol brought over by Russian warships. Are you seeing any of that?
Absolutely. I can't say for certain that it was Russian vehicles, but leaving Simferopol this morning, there must have been, I counted about 18 vehicles, you know, big army trucks, the transport trucks, and couldn't exactly tell if there was troops in the back. But the main highway between Sevastopol and Simferopol, we saw this huge convoy, and we're hearing reports that Russian ships brought in more troops and supplies today here at this port. So we know they're here. In all, we've been told that there are about 30,000 Russian troops here, and that's quite a lot more than the 6,000 that were based here before all this broke out, it's about 3 weeks ago now.
Now, one of the key things about Sevastopol is that Russia and Ukraine share a naval base. Is that sharing still going on, or is basically Russia taken over the naval base?
They've taken it over. And what they've done is they've basically, here in Sevastopol, they've forced the Ukrainians into their quarters. They're not allowed to leave. And the ships aren't allowed to leave. And I just want to tell a quick story. I spent the day on board another big Ukrainian Navy ship. This ship is being blocked. The Russians have actually sunk three of their own vessels at the entrance to the inlet. And so the ships can't get out. They prevented that, and that's meant, you know, these hundreds of sailors are now on their boat, humiliated They're not able to leave, and they're faced with this choice. What happens if Crimea becomes Russia? Do they go to Ukraine, or do they join the Russian Navy? And all the sailors I spoke to the other day said, well, that's not even a choice. They're going to stick with their Navy. They've sworn an oath, and they're going to stick with Ukraine.
So, Derek, you say people there are really expecting the referendum to pass on Sunday. If it does, what do you expect is next for Crimea?
The biggest thing is the uncertainty, and we're seeing that in small ways. You know, the bank machine just outside the hotel where I am now, 10, 15 people waiting at that bank machine to take out money because they don't know they'll be able to do that after the referendum.
The CBC's Derek Stoffel, he's been speaking to us from Sevastopol, the largest city in Crimea. Thanks so much, Derek.
You're welcome.
Alina Simone, who we hear from regularly on the show, has been monitoring the news out of Ukraine, especially the news out of Kharkov in the east. It's been the scene of some violent protests. Alina was born in Kharkov when it was part of the Soviet Union, so for her, the news feels close to home. And then something happened there that came even closer.
Last week, something flashed across my screen that I never expected to see. News about the Kharkov Zoo. A German researcher tweeted that funding from Kiev had been cut off and the animals were starving. Within days, the story made international headlines. The Kharkov Zoo occupies an almost mythological place in my family. It's where my father worked as a night watchman after he was blacklisted by the KGB.
When I lived in Kharkov, KGB had something against me, and it was hard for me to get any job, at least any decent job.
My dad's a physicist now in the U.S., but in Soviet Kharkov, he couldn't go to grad school, publish his work, or hold any meaningful job. This was undoubtedly the darkest period in his life, but my dad still loves that zoo. When I returned to Kharkov, it was one of the first places I went to visit. So when I heard about the troubles at the zoo, I called my dad. He still has memories of working there, vivid memories of sinister coworkers.
One of them actually was a driver. During the Stalin times, he was like an older fellow. He was a driver. He drove people who came to arrest people, you know.
And sad animals.
I would walk around the zoo and some animals will come to meet me, deer in particular. They look pretty sad and I would talk to them a little. So that's... Somebody stole a swan and somebody stole an eagle. Luckily not on my shift, but... I can imagine the swan, they probably eaten it, but the eagle, I don't know.
It's kind of hard to imagine what someone would have done with an eagle in a communist apartment where you share a kitchen with five other families.
Sadly, I lost my job because someone told the director of the zoo that I had a higher education. I don't know what was the law, but the director told me that I was overqualified. By that time, I pretty much decided to emigrate. So there was some hope on the horizon. And, you know, when I looked at those animals, I thought they would also wouldn't mind getting out of those cages.
My dad returned to Kharkov and the zoo in 2011, 35 years after he left.
I went with my friend, and I was happy to see that the conditions of the animals have improved.
As soon as I told my dad about the crisis at the zoo, he immediately put the word out to his emigre friends. Some are Russian, some are Ukrainian. Everyone wants to help. But when I called the zoo's deputy director, Alexandra Tsikhanskaya, she seemed almost hurt that anyone would think they'd let their animals starve. When food started to run low, the director went on local television and made an emergency appeal. She told me, the people of Kharkov didn't just run. Everyone in the city rushed to the zoo. Attendants soared. They brought us so much food, we can probably use it for the next 3 months. And despite protests in nearby Lenin Square, over 77,000 people bought tickets to the zoo in just 3 days, and donations poured in from all over the world. I feel like there's got to be some kind of political lesson here. Maybe the Kharkov Zoo should run for president of Ukraine. As for Tsikhanskaya, her dream is to turn Ukraine's oldest zoo into a world-class institution and replace cages that are, in some cases, more than 70 years old. No more sad animals. My dad would definitely agree with that. For The World, this is Alina Simone from New York.
Alina is not alone here in the U.S. and feeling like the crisis in Ukraine hits close to home. In our First Day series, we ask immigrants to recount their first memories of life in this country. Let's hear now from one young Ukrainian who's following the news back home from her new home in California.
My name is Lesya Pishevskaya, and I'm from Kyiv, Ukraine. I came here on August 5th, 2005. I was 19. In the U.S., I've been for 8.5 years. One funny thing that I learned here is that people don't use halves. When they say their age, they say just, you know, I'm this or this. But in Ukraine, we say half. So, you know, I'm 20 and a half, or I'm 20, or I'm 28 and a half. I'm getting old. but here, people laugh when you say that, you know? They only say, like, I'm 28, I'm 30. So I left when I was 19. I got a chance to come here and study here. Well, one thing was, the way people dress. It was something shocking to me in a way that, like, people would wear pajama-looking clothes to school in Ukraine. You would have to wear something more formal, not like a uniform, but still, like, at least pants, a blouse. Anytime I said, you know, I'm Lesya, I'm from Ukraine, the first question I would get asked is, where is Ukraine? What is Ukraine? Is Ukraine part of Russia? And I would just absolutely hate the question, you know, because Ukraine is not part of Russia. And I would say, you know, where is Canada? Is it part of U.S.? Or where is U.S.? Is it part of Canada? It's the same thing. So people can relate and understand how it feels for me when I'm asked whether Ukraine is part of Russia. Through this movement in the last 4 months, I'm proud that it happened because people seem to care about their country, about their national identity. And during the protests in Kyiv, it was very scary for my mom because one time she was outside and she got into the crowd of these, you know, street protesters who were against the movement. And she said she was so scared that she came home. And her legs were shaking for two hours after that. And then in a couple of weeks, as the movement was progressing, I was just sitting at home, and I felt like I could not just sit and passively watch anymore. And I said, okay, why don't we organize something here so that we can show support to Ukrainians in Ukraine? And within 1 week, we organized this 500 people demonstration by the Ukrainian consulate in San Francisco. And we actually live streamed the event through the main square in Kyiv. And when we sang the anthem, people in there sang the anthem too. So we united with them. And some people would think that we are anti-Russian and we're just, you know, anti-oligarchs and anti-dictatorship. And we're, you know, all together in this fight. I feel like going home, and I really felt like going home during the revolution, because I am a revolutionary at heart, but at least I'm doing something here and bringing people together around this issue. So we keep doing that.
That's Ukrainian immigrant Lesya Pishevskaya. She told her story to the world's Monica Campbell as part of our First Days series. Share your story about first arriving in the U.S. at PRI.org/firstdays and join the conversation using the hashtag First Days. Later on the program, the ongoing mystery of the missing Malaysia Airlines jet. This pilot says it's not that far-fetched to lose track of a plane once it loses power.
We're so into the immediacy and connectivity of life today. But if somebody comes around to the back of your computer and pulls the plug out, you know, suddenly the internet doesn't exist anymore. In the end, to some degree, it's really just all about electricity.
No electricity, no communication. That's ahead on The World. This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon or Medtronic 10-Mile Run. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes.
I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Monday is St. Patrick's Day, of course. But do you know what Sunday is? It's St. Urho's Day. And for our flash geo quiz today, you have to guess who celebrates that? Here are the clues. Urho is a man's name in Finland, but it's Americans who celebrate St. Urho. So the answer is, you probably guessed it, Finnish Americans. Well, not all of them, perhaps, but enough to make it a tradition, apparently. Dan Crocker of Minnesota Public Radio explains.
At the main intersection in Finland, Minnesota, stands a tall wooden carved statue of a bearded man with his mouth wide open, apparently shouting.
What Steinerhoff's saying was grasshopper, grasshopper, go away. And I think it was heine circa, menetalahitin or something like that. My pronunciation is probably not great. Finnish people are probably going to laugh at that.
Anna Schaulin coordinates the St. Urho's Day parade and celebration in Finland. She says legend has it that sometime long ago, grasshoppers invaded Finland, the country, threatening its grapes. Then in stepped St. Urho.
He's got his mouth open. He's got a big mouth. He yelled really loud and they ran away. That's the legend.
And for 39 years now, the 300 or so people in this little town in the North Woods have celebrated that story. Amy Gardner, preparing for her 24th St. Urho's, is cutting out cardboard grasshopper heads for a kids' game.
Every year, that's the theme. It's grasshoppers, grapes, and St. Urho, and the colors are purple and green.
So are you of Finnish descent?
Not at all.
It's a heck of a party.
You know, after a long winter and we've all got a bad case of cabin fever, to come out of our homes and see our neighbors and be totally silly out in the streets is really a wonderful relief.
And like the more famous holiday it precedes by a day, St. Urho's typically involves alcohol, says Angela Mackey Jones. She makes the four-hour drive north from Minneapolis every March.
There's also a myth that Urho did this the day before St. Patrick's Day so that the Finns could celebrate and drink all the whiskey before the Irish got to it.
Now, according to actual history, two northern Minnesota men concocted the story in the 1950s. Tim Winker is a self-described Finnophile who runs a website devoted to St. Urho's Day. He says a man named Richard Matson probably came up with the idea.
Well, you know, everybody celebrates St. Patrick. What about all of us Finns? We need a hero, too.
And as tall tales tend to do, says Winker, the legend spread.
Florida, Oregon, Butte, Montana, there are little groups of Finns that hold a St. Urho's Day celebration every year, and there's a few more every year.
But what about in the mother country?
Esa Mustonen.
I got a hold of Esa Mustonen, who manages St. Urho's Pub in Helsinki. It turns out the bar isn't named after the American made-up saint, but former Finnish president Urho Kekkonen.
In Finland, we don't celebrate St. Urho's Day, well, actually, at all.
But Mustonen is familiar with the story. He says despite the fake saint's valiant efforts, there are still grasshoppers in Finland, and the country still doesn't grow any wine grapes. For The World, I'm Dan Crocker, Finland, Minnesota.
You've probably heard about the U.S. Marine Corps Band, but there are actually several Marine Corps bands and related groups that perform around the U.S. and overseas. One of them is the Marine Corps Jazz Ensemble that recently toured the Northeast. They stopped in Boston, and my colleague Marco Werman invited them to come to our studios here at WGBH for a chat and to perform some of their music.
That song was Quarter to One, a composition by Ken Ebo, who was actually leading the band today, the band being the U.S. Marine Corps Jazz Ensemble. Ken, that's a big band sound produced by just six players. So is it just because you guys are the Marines and you swing pretty heavy?
Well, like they say, you know, the Marines do a lot more with less, so we try to achieve that sound with just the sextet.
What is the history of the Marine Corps Jazz Ensemble?
Well, every Marine Corps band, there's 10 different Marine Corps fleet bands, and they have different ensembles, concert bands, brass quintets, jazz big bands, jazz combos, etc. And this particular ensemble is a mixture of personnel from several of those different ensembles. So we put it together as a special tour up here in the New England area to do some recruiting tours. We came together and rehearsed for 2 days and hit the road.
Wow. So when you say recruitment tool to get more people involved in the Marines Jazz Ensemble and music department, or is it to get them in the Marines? And by the way, if you play an instrument, that's a great thing too.
For our specialty, you have to do an audition. You don't have to be qualified just to get into the Marine Corps, but you have to be qualified to get into the Marine music program as well. So we go to schools and colleges to kind of give some exposure to what we do, to the opportunities available in the music program. We are also that face of the Marine Corps. If we do a concert out somewhere in the Midwest or somewhere else, we may be the only Marine that someone sees, except for on the news or something like that. So there's like that community connection.
You must know Charlie Parker's dictum, if you don't live it won't come out your horn. You know that one?
That's right.
So you've served in Iraq. You're involved in kind of like big issues in the world today as U.S. Marines.
Yes.
How does that come out of your horn?
Well, all instrumentalists, I believe, feel that the instrument is an extension of themselves. And particularly in jazz, when the big part of our music is improvisation. And improvisation is not just making it up as you go along. It's the ability to be creative within and around a known set of boundaries for which you've prepared a great deal. And that is right in line with the ethos of the Marine Corps. A lot of Marines have prepared and we train for war, but some are not deployed, you know. The Marines like to say that, you know, nobody likes to fight, but somebody has to know how. And so we train like that. And in music, it's the same thing. We do a lot of preparation on our own so that when we come together as a group, which is something bigger than ourselves, again, another correlation with the Marines, that we can make a viable statement as extension of what we are to communicate with our audience.
Well, the solos in that first number, Quarter to One, were fantastic. And two things strike me. Incredible precision, but also you guys showed up on time, which is something that a lot of jazz ensembles don't do.
That's right. That's where we're breaking ranks with jazz musicians at large, I believe.
So not only are you a trombone player and a pretty darn good one at that, Staff Sergeant Ebo, you're also a vocalist, so you're a double threat. You're going to close out with a tune that I love. Tell us what we're going to hear.
We're going to hear a great jazz standard. It's called It Could Happen to You. The band gets to shine on this, our piano player, Sergeant Devin Penner, and our trumpet player who's going to play flugelhorn on this tune. And the whole band, every time he picks that flugelhorn up, Gunny Sergeant Tim Otis, you know, we're like, okay, here it comes. So it's a wonderful moment in our concerts.
Well, Staff Sergeant Ken Ebo and the gentlemen in the U.S. Marine Corps Jazz Ensemble, thanks so much for coming in and performing and speaking with us today.
Thank you for having us. It's a pleasure.
Hide your heart from sight. Lock your dreams up tight. It could happen to you. Don't count stars or you might stumble. Someone drops a sigh and down you tumble. Keep away from spring.
You can see the U.S. Marine Corps Jazz Ensemble performing in our studios. We got video at PRI.org.
All I did was wonder how your arms might be.
This is PRI. I'm Carol Hills. Ahead, the mystery of Flight 370 thrusts Malaysia's leaders into an uncomfortable spotlight.
Malaysia is very much a globalized top 20 trading nation in the world, except its politics hasn't quite caught up. It still has this political culture that is stuck in a sort of feudal time warp.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon or Medtronic 10-Mile Run. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes.
I'm Carol Hills, in for Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. On Monday, March 17th, millions of Americans will celebrate St. Patrick, a man who died more than 1,500 years ago. Probably a lot fewer will remember the date for a much more recent event, the end, 40 years ago, of the Arab oil embargo. The 5-month embargo was slapped on the U.S. in retaliation for its support of Israel in the 1973 Yom Kippur War, and it was a kick in the teeth to a country that had grown to depend on cheap oil. It challenged America's car culture, the idea that we could go anywhere, anytime, at almost no cost. Before the embargo, it seemed only kooks and hippies drove efficient small cars. After the embargo, well, here's reporter John Miller.
Every summer when I was a kid, my family would hitch a tent trailer to our station wagon, turn on the radio, and just take off.
Bound for the mountains and the plains.
Sometimes we'd travel 10,000 miles around the country.
I loved it, and I felt darn good that I had a family that loved doing these things.
That's my dad, Mike Miller. Back in the 70s, he was a school teacher, and the big perk was the long summer vacation. The open road was freedom.
Yeah, it was freedom. Yeah. It was. Going down that long, lonesome highway.
Gonna live life my way. My father was a Plymouth man. The one I remember best was a 1968 avocado green Fury Suburban.
Introducing the 68 Plymouth Fury, the car designed to win you over.
This was a big, boxy thing that looked to us very modern.
We made it look wider.
It was a boat. It got terrible mileage, but that didn't matter because gas was so cheap. Then suddenly it wasn't.
It's a crazy situation. I've never seen lines like I've seen these past days.
October 1973, UPI's Brian McFadden reported from New Jersey.
Almost half of the cars in the line that I was in ran out of gas before they reached the station, and we all had to pitch in and help push them to the pump.
With the squeeze in supply, prices spiked for gasoline and heating oil and electricity. President Richard Nixon urged us to take immediate measures to rein in our energy use.
These steps include reductions in home heating, reductions in driving speeds, elimination of unnecessary lighting. And the American people, all of you have responded to this challenge with that spirit of sacrifice which has made this such a great nation.
I'd just turned 13 and only barely remember all this. My dad's memory is much better than mine, but he barely remembers it either.
Isn't that interesting? I don't recall us limiting our activities or the distances we traveled.
Folks did reduce their driving.
Tony Dutzik studies driving trends for a think tank called the Frontier Group.
But it was a relatively small interruption in what had been before and continued to be a fairly steady run-up in the number of miles that people have driven.
The embargo was lifted, prices dropped, and we took to the road again. We may have had an inkling that oil was finite or that it was dominating our foreign policy or fouling our air, but we just kept driving.
History shows that people respond most significantly in terms of changing the way they consume energy when, for whatever reason, prices rise.
Jeffrey Ball is an energy researcher at Stanford. He says in Europe, which was also hit by the embargo, governments decided to jack up fuel taxes to keep consumption down. And it worked. Today, the French and Germans use about half as much oil per person as we Americans do. But in the United States, gas taxes are a much tougher sell.
There's a saying in energy circles that what Americans really want are hot showers and cold beer. When you start to ask them to live in a way in which their showers are cooler and their beer is warmer, that becomes a problem.
But a funny thing happened on the way to the future. People's behavior did start to change.
The period that we're in now is the longest sustained decline in driving since World War II.
The Frontier Group's Tony Dutzik says Americans have been driving fewer miles on average every year since 2005, right around when gas prices last shot up. Whether it's just about the money or environmental concerns or a broader cultural shift, more of us are turning to mass transit, car sharing, biking, and walking.
There's really no shortage of reasons for wanting to use less oil, and there's also no shortage of opportunities to do it.
That message resonates most with people born long after the crisis of 1973 and 74 had disappeared in the rearview mirror.
The Toyota Prius, the hybrid that powered a decade.
For those of us who can't quite break the habit, at least our cars are changing. The most enduring legacy of the oil embargo may be the fuel efficiency standards imposed on automakers in the wake of the crisis. Today, the average passenger vehicle in the U.S. gets almost twice the miles per gallon of the cars from when I was a kid.
Over the last 10 years, you've saved an estimated 650 million gallons of gasoline.
A few years ago, my father bought a hybrid. He says it's his favorite of all the cars he's owned. He especially likes to track his gas mileage when he hits the open road. For the world, I'm John Miller.
You can hear the first of John's reports on the legacy of the Arab oil embargo and grab a look at that styling 68 Plymouth Fury wagon. at PRI.org. Still no word on the fate of Malaysia Airlines Flight 370. The plane with its 239 passengers and crew vanished almost a week ago. Confusion has marked the investigation all week. Even now, amid reports suggesting the plane flew for several hours towards the Indian Ocean, investigators still appear to have no firm clues as to its whereabouts. Almost from the start, Malaysian officials have been criticized for their handling of the crisis. They've been accused of being slow to release information and then of giving contradictory accounts. Kian Wong is a Malaysian journalist currently based in Washington. He says he's not especially surprised by the performance of Malaysia's officials and politicians.
I suppose it really comes down to the problem of a rather monocultural political scene where you've had this party or coalition in power ever since Malaysia's independence over 50 years ago. And you've had a sort of inbreeding, if you like, of a lot of the culture. Yet at the same time, Malaysia is very much a globalized top 20 trading nation in the world, and it engages with the world in a pretty open, modern manner, except its politics hasn't quite caught up. It still has this political culture that is stuck in a sort of feudal time warp.
It's been interesting to see these press conferences and to kind of hear about the missteps or, you know, three different press releases in a day. It seems like Malaysian officials seem to be sort of in denial about just the fact that the whole world is watching them. Let's hear a bit of that now from the defense minister, Hishamuddin Hussein, speaking with reporters earlier this week.
This is utter confusion now.
I don't think so. I think it's far from it. It's only confusion if you want it to be seen to be confusion. We have made it very clear that we've been very consistent in our approach.
And that was the transport minister. He's also the defense minister, Hishamuddin Hussein, who is, in fact, the cousin of Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak. Kian Wong, how do you see the answers we're hearing? Do you see it as confusing?
It has been. And I think, basically, even a lot of rather vociferous local commentators have acknowledged and lambasted the government for ineptly handling the critical first few days of this search and rescue operation. I mean, in many ways, it's unprecedented such a crisis has occurred. But it also, I guess, reveals, you know, all these shortcomings of how the government has been run and the limits that the political system and the hobbled democracy has thrown up. Lots of problems with the lack of talent at the top echelons. However, having said that, Hisham Hussein, the defense minister and acting transport minister, is probably among the best and most articulate of them. And I think the daily press conferences clearly have improved since he started helming them the last few days.
Kian, you were the BBC correspondent in Kuala Lumpur for 5 years. That was from 1998 to 2003. Did you encounter the Malaysian government's discomfort with direct questions firsthand?
Oh, many times, many times. But I think, you know, some of this has to do with also the traditional culture that applies not only in Malaysia, but across Southeast Asia, in my experiences of reporting from Indonesia and Singapore as well, where that Western reporting direct questioning style is in many ways at odds with a more traditional, forgiving, if more, you know, polite type of inquiry that occurs. But, you know, you can't excuse all of that, obviously, on just the culture alone. There is a problem that has been prevailing in Malaysia for some time over the way information is given, especially in a modern globalized economy like Malaysia, where to ration these things becomes very difficult, especially with the internet being free and open like it is in Malaysia.
Malaysian journalist Kian Wong, thank you so much.
Thanks.
There's a crisis on farms all across America. Young people don't want to work there. The FFA, a group formerly known as the Future Farmers of America, knows the problem well. The FFA was founded way back in 1928 to get students more engaged in agriculture. It works with the U.S. Departments of Education and Agriculture, and one solution the FFA is working on these days is getting more minorities, often immigrants, interested in running the farm. That includes kids who live in urban areas and who may not have a family background in agriculture. The World's Jason Margolis reports from Buena Park, California.
Buena Park is a sea of concrete. The closest thing to a farm here is Knott's Berry Farm, a popular amusement park.
Adventure to the back of Buena Park High School's campus, and you'll find pigs, chickens, and steers. And students like sophomore Nathan Talavera driving a tractor. Talavera was born in California. His parents are from Mexico City. He had no experience with farming when a friend told him about the ag program at Buena Park High.
Well, I really like animals, so I decided to get a pig, and I fell in love with pigs. And now every year I've had 3 pigs so far.
Talavera raised the pigs, then sold them at the Orange County Fair. Students can earn $50 to $500 doing this. Not bad. Senior Urfia Abdul raised rabbits.
Feeding them in the morning, in the evening, cleaning their little cage, giving them water.
After that, she moved up to goats. Abdul was born nearby, but moved to India when she was 1. A few years ago, her parents sent her back to Orange County to live with her uncle.
The first semester, almost cried every single day because I was so homesick.
Then she discovered the ag program.
I guess this program has just given me a place to call home. Yeah, cleaning poop doesn't sound that amazing or fun, but when you're there cleaning poop of the animal, there are 5 other friends that are doing the same thing. It just builds more friendships, more memories.
This is not the real Orange County I saw on MTV. At Buena Park High, 26 languages are spoken on campus, but most of the students are Latino. Those students well know the model on most American farms. White farmers own the land, while Latinos do the hard manual labor. According to the U.S. Census, Hispanics are the principal operators of less than 3% of the nation's farms. Teachers at Buena Park High would like to change that. Besides learning to drive a tractor, students study things like the business of farming and ag sciences.
So on the protein, did anybody get a positive?
Jessica Fernandez heads the ag department at Buena Park High. She's leading a lab experiment. Students are analyzing the fat, sugar, and protein content of animal feed in test tubes. Many of the students here have relatives who do the low-wage, difficult farm work, like picking fruits and vegetables. Fernandez wants her students to take pride in them, but also know there's other jobs on the farm, too.
There are so many steps from planting that seed to getting it all the way to the grocery store and what happens to convince you or I to buy that product. There are hundreds of jobs surrounding the agriculture industry.
The student, Nathan Talavera, who drove the tractor and raised pigs, wants to be a veterinarian. Urfia Abdul is considering a career in accounting within agriculture. Besides being a teacher, Fernandez works with the FFA. Under her guidance, the ag program at Buena Park High has expanded from 60 students to nearly 500 in 9 years. Impressive growth, but that still leaves 3/4 of the student body uninterested in agriculture. Buena Park is a major success story. At other urban high schools, most students have probably never even heard of the FFA. That worries America's farm industry.
I would say crisis might be the right word because we are in desperate need of young farmers to carry on the tradition.
Steve Brown chairs the National FFA Board. His organization is piloting programs in Atlanta and San Antonio to reach Black and Latino students. Brown says their pitch to lower-income minorities is pretty straightforward. There are jobs for them on the farm.
They're very employable. There is a strong need, and that need will continue as the baby boomers retire. There is a huge demand as well as huge opportunity.
Jessica Fernandez says her students also see farming as a way to get to college.
If you are in agriculture classes and you become a program completer, which means staying for the 4 years and being actively involved, you have access to a $2 million pot of scholarships that no other kid on campus has access to.
Add it all up, the scholarships, the jobs, the cash for raising animals, the pig pen at Buena Park High has become a popular hangout. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis, Buena Park, California.
See how some of those future farmers are learning. We have a video of the students at Buena Park High at PRI.org. You're listening to PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. I want to return to that vanished Malaysia Airlines jet. As we said earlier, investigators still have no firm clues as to where the missing plane went. And let's face it, most of us can't really understand how that's even possible. Patrick Smith is a pilot and the author of Cockpit Confidential. He's worried about the public's demand for fast, easy answers.
In a lot of respects, this story has moved from being a story about a presumed airplane crash to a mystery story, really, a story about where is the airplane. And we're following it almost the way people would follow a celebrity murder trial. And the verdict now, so to speak, is instead of guilty or not guilty, is where and when are they going to find this airplane? And you know, that worries me a little bit, because I wonder if when they do find it, suddenly everybody's attention just tapers off. And that's too bad, because the real questions here should be about what happened on board the plane, not where is the plane.
Is there a precedent for this situation? Has there ever been a plane this size that simply has disappeared and never been found?
A week, more or less, of having not found a commercial aircraft with over 200 people on board is extremely unusual and unexpected. But at the same time, it's not entirely startling to me. You know, the oceans are very big, and an airplane in that context, even a wide-body jetliner, is very, very small. So people hear that, and okay, but they want to know, how do you just lose contact with a jet? Something as sophisticated as a jetliner with all of this fancy cockpit equipment that's sending out messages automatically. And then, you know, meanwhile, air crews are always in contact with air traffic control and also with company staff on the ground, one way or the other, whether that communication is over the radio or by satellite or by what we call data link. But it's also possible that all of that fancy equipment can be turned off, whether intentionally or through some cascading or catastrophic mechanical malfunction. Think of it this way. You know, we're so into the immediacy and connectivity of life today. But if somebody comes around to the back of your computer and pulls the plug out, you know, suddenly the internet doesn't exist anymore. In the end, to some degree, it's really just all about electricity. And if you have an airplane with no power, all of the satellite communication and all of this other stuff we have just isn't going to work anymore. And so, it is plausible that a plane can just, quote unquote, disappear.
As you've already mentioned in this interview, there's been so much speculation. What's the psychology behind all that speculation?
That's a great question. I think the lack of information is inspiring people to come up with these increasingly outlandish theories. The plane is in North Korea, or it landed in Somalia or Pakistan. People need to at least prepare for the possibility that we might never know what happened. You know, having said that, one thing that I'd hope doesn't happen with this incident is that it doesn't undermine the fact that last year, 2013, was the safest year in the entire history of commercial aviation worldwide. And we've engineered away what used to be the common expected causes of accidents, and we're kind of left with these stranger ones that don't happen very often. But they do have a mystique and a sense of mystery to them, and that causes people to really focus on them, and they become these media spectacles. And that, I think, unfortunately, encourages people to see flying as more dangerous than it really is. It's never been safer than it is right now.
Pilot Patrick Smith is the author of Cockpit Confidential. Thanks so much, Patrick.
Thank you. Anytime.
Finally today, some Afghan indie rock. The group Cobble Dreams is considered the first rock band to emerge from post-Taliban Afghanistan. And last night, the group played its first U.S. concert at South by Southwest. Shuka Kalantari has the band's story.
When Afghan musician Suleiman Kardash decided to organize a rock concert at downtown Kabul's busiest street market, local security forces immediately asked him to stop.
We said no, because give me one logical reason that I should stop it. Then I will stop. If it's not prayer time, it's not something. We organize everything by ourselves.
The logical reason Afghan security gave was security. There had been two suicide bombings in the neighborhood that week, and police didn't want to attract another one. That was in 2011. The band decided to play anyway. Kardash, the lead singer and guitarist of Kabul Dreams, says they were tired of living in fear. They figured an outdoor concert would help people find the courage to gather publicly again. Those frequent bombings come up in a song called Air, on Kabul Dreams' first album, Plastic Words.
Bombs and explosions are not scaring me. They are just playing with my heart sometimes.
Kardash says that first outdoor concert helped to broaden the band's appeal. Before, they would only play at private universities and cultural centers, concerts for Afghanistan's elite. This was a chance for all types of young people to hear indie rock music.
Car washers and beggars and some, like, you know. So basically, our focus was on them, like, okay, let's play music, because kids are kids, no matter if they live in Kabul or in San Francisco. It doesn't matter, because they want fun.
Kabul Dreams plays music in both English and Dari, one of Afghanistan's native languages. The song Sedo Eman, or My Voice, is about the importance of Afghanistan's youth having a collective voice. Kardash actually grew up in neighboring Uzbekistan and moved to Kabul in 2008. He immediately stood out in his skinny jeans and Converse sneakers. He said he'd get a lot of stares, but people mostly left him alone, until he started Kabul Dreams. That's when the band started getting death threats.
When there is something new, always there is a reaction, because acceptance is actually not easy. Because rock music, it's unusual for Afghans' ears.
The band has kept a mostly low profile since then. They never advertised their concerts for fear it would attract extremists. And they kept street concerts to a minimum. Siddiq Ahmad, the bassist for Kabul Dreams, says this extremist, anti-music mentality isn't what Afghanistan is really about.
In Afghanistan as a whole, people love music all the time. Music is part of our wedding ceremonies, our other ceremonies that we have, that we celebrate. And it has always been there, always. Since there was Afghanistan, it has always been there.
I'm Shuka Kalantari, San Francisco.
That's our program today. Eric Goldberg composed the world's theme music. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Have a great weekend.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the Annenberg Foundation, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, GatesFoundation.org, the Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and strengthening international peace and security at Carnegie.org, the Ford Foundation, the Henry Luce Foundation for Increased Understanding of East and Southeast Asia, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org, and by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Catherine Harris and the Hegart Foundation, Linda Larson and Jerry Johnson, the Rose Family Fund, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and Roger Hale and Nor Hall.
PRI, Public Radio International.